The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
So we spoke about last time, the question of what Shabbat was about. And I told you that a lot of people have a perception that Shabbat is all about don't. And that the Pasuk says, Sheshtem Yitavodu V'asita Kol Melachtecha, right? 6 days you do work, Avodah, and Melacha, labor. V'yom HaShavi'i Shabbat L'Hashem Elokecha, Lo Tasebo Kol Melacha. And you don't do Melacha, right? So we asked, what's the difference between Avodah, which I do during the week, but it does not say that I don't do Avodah and Shabbat, and Melacha, which I'm not supposed to do in Shabbat. So we talk about Rav Shimshon Feldhurst's idea that Melacha is really not about creativity, it's about productivity. When I produce a difference in the world, right? When I change something in the world. And then one day a week, I want to remember that part of the goal of the world is not that I change the world, but that the world should change me. That the question is not what I'm doing, but why I'm doing it. And therefore on Shabbat, we choose to desist from all those things that physically, at least in the physical world, create the illusion that we are in partnership with God. Right? And then we asked, well, there seems to be one item that doesn't fit with this, which is carrying. Because when I light a fire, I understand that I produce a change. And one day a week, I want to remember to take a step off of that rat race. I want to remember that there are things that I don't do. I want to remember that I'm a junior partner. But when it comes to carrying, pick something up here, put it back, what have you really done? So we spoke about the fact that, the message of carrying is that when I carry something, I make a demonstration, I make a statement that it belongs to me. And one day a week I want to remember that I don't really own anything in this world. And so therefore I don't carry. I choose to, sort of let go on a certain level of making a statement of ownership. Which, by the way, is why when you're in your house, it doesn't matter if you carry. Because the statement's already made, etc., etc. And then we left off with one last question, which was, anybody remember? Question of Eluf. Okay. That's okay. Davening for Shabbos, that's good. So, the question is, what is an Eluf? An Eluf is such a weird, what does it mean that if I'm behind a wire, or in front of a wire? So if you remember, I told you a story that I once got stuck on the West Side Highway. I think that was the story we get into, right? And I did this really weird thing. The question is that? What is a shiva? I think, and this isn't an objective truth, this is just the way I look at it, and I understand Rosh Hashanah Farah Hirsch as looking at it in this way. I think that if the only way to do something is by virtue of a shiva, of doing it in such a weird way, then what Chazal, what the rabbi is really saying, is that you want to remember on Shabbat to let go of the illusion that you're in control. But the rabbis didn't want to decree on everything, and therefore, on those areas, for example, if someone's sick, if the only way you can do it is with a shiur, is in such a cockamamie way, that even when you do it, you remember that really in an ideal world you wouldn't be doing it. You remember that it's not really yours to do. And that may well be the idea behind an Eruv. It's precisely because an Eruv is such a strange way of declaring a domain as to not even be a domain, that you remember that if you're carrying inside an Eruv, even though you're making a statement that it belongs to you, you remember that it really doesn't belong to you. Make sense? That's the idea of an Eruv. And I think we also mentioned that, you know, if you look at it, you can model. So, carrying, even though the Tosfos in Gila and Afe calls carrying a melacha gevura, it's sort of a step below the other melachot, because it doesn't seem like you're accomplishing anything. And yet if you look in the Gemara, carrying would seem to be the labor that is most of concern to Chazal. For example, you don't blow shofar in Shabbat lest you come to carry. That's what Gemara says. In the fourth parak of Rosh Hashanah, it says, a person is not supposed to blow shofar במקדש היו תוקד לרבו שופר בבית המקדש. לרבו שופר בבית המקדש עד שבת. In fact, there's a great, stop me if you did this already, there's a great discussion with Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. The Mishnah says that on Rosh Hashanah, it's already a labor, right? And on Rosh Hashanah, Shechel Yom Shabbat, when Rosh Hashanah would fall on Shabbat, right? So, Bamikdash Hayu Tokid, they would blow on the Beit HaMikdash. When the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, they stopped blowing Shofar on Shabbat. One year, it came Shabbat, and it was Rosh Hashanah. So Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai felt they had reestablished the Sanhedrin in Yavne, right? The Sanhedrin had stopped sitting for a while after the destruction, and then Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai reestablished it in Yavne. So he said, Nitka, you should blow Shofar, even on Shabbat. We're sitting with Sanhedrin. So the B'nai B'Taylor, now it's not clear who the B'nai B'Taylor were. I look at them as like the Shul board. You know, Rav Yochanan Zakkai, he says, look, we got to blow. And the board says, where is it? Nadun. We have to discuss it. We have to have a committee meeting. So Rav Yochanan Zakkai says, Eit lasok Hashem, you don't have time. Nitka. You know. V'yachakach nadun. It's Rosh Hashanah. We're going to have a committee meeting. We have to blow Shofar. Later we'll discuss it. So they said, okay. So they blew. They figured they blow this Rosh Hashanah. And then they have a meeting about next time. So after Rosh Hashanah, maybe they would come back to Rav Yochanan Zakkai, and they say, no, not done. We blew, but now we have to discuss it. He says, Kvar nishma shofar, the sound of the shofar has already been heard in Yavne on Shabbat. V'ein machrin achar takana. You don't question, you know, decrees that are made. So he was like a politician. So the question is, what is this story? Why don't you blow shofar on Shabbat? Why don't you blow shofar on Shabbat? And why do you blow shofar on Shabbat in the Beit HaMikdash? And why did you stop blowing Shofar on Shabbat? And why did Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai feel that if there was a Sanhedrin, that all of a sudden you blow Shofar on Shabbat? And even stranger is the debate among the Rishonim, among the medieval authorities, as to what this means, that you can blow Shofar on Shabbat if you're in front of a Beit Din of a court. So there's a four-way debate. There are two opinions in Rashi. One is that it's the High Court Sanhedrin. I have 71 judges. And the other is that it's only that even a Beit Din of 23 judges, Rashi says. Then there's a third opinion, which is Rambam. The Rambam says that as long as this particular Beit Din, Kitzur Tachodesh, they had once received witnesses and declared the new moon, that you could blow in front of that Beit Din also. Then the Rif says you can even blow in front of a regular Beit Din. In fact, there's a famous story with Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, who was a great, great Torah scholar around the end of the 1800s. And they say that one year his heart was very weak. And he just felt that he wasn't going to make it through the year. And that he needed something to give him a little boost. Right? So he decided to try to get a group. There's a halacha that if you have like a mayor of Rabbanim, right? 100 Rabbanim, and they get together. Right? So he decided that he was going to convene 71 of the great rabbis of his day. And they would form a sort of a Sanhedrin so that you could blow Shofar. So everybody agreed. Great idea. And then one by one, you know how it is. Then politics start. This one isn't going. That one can't go. This one isn't going. And that one can't go, you know. So eventually there were only three Dayanim left. There were three Rabbanim, including Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger. And he did. He, in his home, convened a Beis Din. And they blew Shofar that year, on Shabbos, in Yerushalayim. And the legend is that Shmuel Salant, who was the Rabbi of Yerushalayim, who was vehemently against this because he felt it would set a precedent. The Jews weren't ready. So he fought it, and he was the main reason that Rabbanim dropped out. On that Shabbos, since he knew Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger was going to blow, he walked across town to hear him blow and stood outside the door to listen to the tkiyas, Judaism, right? What's the big deal? So the Gemara says, why don't you blow Shofar on Shabbat? Shema yavirenu dalet amot b'rishutai rabbi. Lest a person wants to learn how to blow, he'll go to somebody who knows how to blow Shofar, right? And he'll end up carrying a Shofar four cubits in the public domain on Shabbos. So in order that somebody shouldn't be carrying a Shofar on Shabbos, therefore we don't blow Shofar on Shabbat. Now realize how ridiculous that is. That's unbelievable. I mean, Shofar is one of the essential, it's the only biblical symbol of Rosh Hashanah. The Medrash says that Shofar has the power to cause God to get off Kisei Adin, the throne of justice, and a light to be Aleh al Kisei Rachamim, the throne of Rashid. It's one of the most essential. Halacha is that if you have to skip shul and not daven at all, hear shofar, right? Or go to shul and miss shofar, you're better off hearing shofar. There's a tshuva actually of Moshe talks about this, because he had a case with a rabbi who was in a service here or something. He had psak to be there, and he wasn't going to have a kosher tkiya. He knew that he wasn't going to have shofar in his community, so he leaves the community and go to a place where he could be with a friend and blow shofar. Or was he better off davening? Better to hear shofar than all of davening. And we don't do it. Why? Because one guy, not a guy who's learning how to blow shofar, not a guy who's learning how to blow shofar, and that's why we don't blow shofar in Rosh Hashanah. That's ridiculous. Unless, of course, you understand what we just said. Because first of all, what's the whole idea of carrying? If there was ever a day that the message of the Jewish people, carrying, makes the most sense for Rosh Hashanah. Because the whole message of carrying is that I think that I own it. One day I want to learn that I don't really own it. Who will live with that? And that, by the way, explains why you could blow in the Beit HaMikdash. If there's one place in the world where even if you're carrying something, you remember that you don't really own it, the Beit HaMikdash. When you stand before Hashem in the Beit HaMikdash, you remember that you don't really own anything in this world. And that, by the way, is the secret of standing in front of a Beit Din. Because the idea is that if you're standing in front of a court, and then the question is, what does a court represent? So, for example, I won't go through all four opinions, but Rashi says it could be even a Beit Din of 23. Why? Because it's called a Sanhedrin Katana, small Sanhedrin. You need halachically a minimum of 23 judges to be able to put someone to death. If you're standing in front of a court that has the power to put someone to death, then you remember that you don't really own it, and so on and so forth. Right? So that's how crucial this idea is. And therefore, if Eruv is about remembering that even when I do carry, Chazal wanted me to carry with me the message, right, that I'm not really in control, then all of a sudden the world of Eruv makes a little more sense. Okay? So before we move any deeper into Shabbat, any questions? Yeah?
Why can't they leave the shofar in the shul before Shabbat when they know they wanted to blow it?
That is an excellent question. Okay. In fact, first of all, that's the question of Tosos. Take the stage further. We do this every Shabbos. We read Torah, right? What if somebody doesn't know how to read the Torah and takes a Torah shul somewhere? We use Siddurim. What if somebody doesn't know how to daven and takes a Siddur? So the two ways, right? Does everybody understand the question? Why dafka a shofar, we don't blow my carry? So there are two opinions on this. At least that makes sense to me. One is that the issue here is not about the practicality. This is a mistake people make. You know, very often halacha is not about the practicality. In other words, we very often, because we focus on the detail of halacha, we forget that halacha is also a vehicle for tremendous messages. You know, Judaism does not believe that the greatest value is the idea. Judaism absolutely believes that the greatest value is the action, is what I do. The whole premise of our discussions is that if I'm doing it, but I'm not getting it, I'm missing something. But there's no doubt in Judaism that if I would have to choose between doing it and not getting it, or getting it and not doing it, that doing it is what makes more sense, right? And therefore, very often in the halachic world, there are deep messages behind the idea. And this is a perfect example. In other words, there's a message that goes along with this particular detail, so that the opportunity to send such a message to the entire Jewish people, even though the possibility and the probability is so remote regarding shofar, is what's paramount. And therefore, there must be a connection specifically with the shofar and carrying in Rosh Hashanah. That's one possibility. The other possibility is what's called Rov Me'adam. In other words, the probability of a person needing to carry to get a siddur, since siddurim are such a regular part of our lives, never entered the realm of decree, right? Whereas, and it's interesting, all the things that we do at Shabbat, since we do them every week, it's assumed that you have halacha, don't carry. You have a way to carry, it's called an eruv. These are the things we do every week, so we're not going to forget. But when you deal with the things that are sort of out of the box, you know, that you do once a year, a shofar, a lulav, right? I think we mentioned this because this is also worth mentioning. Can I tell you about the difference between the Zohar's question regarding shofar and Rosh Hashanah and Erusin engagement and marriage? Can we talk about this? Oh, this fits with this as well. This is a, it's such a beautiful idea. I heard this once from Rabbi Riskin. The Zohar asked the same question. He says, why don't we carry, why don't we blow shofar and Rosh Hashanah? Just because we won't carry on Shabbat. And he asked this question to all the things. We don't use a lulav metro for Purim on Shabbat for the same reason, right? We don't read Megillah, we don't have Purim on Shabbat, lest somebody carry Megillah. All of these once in a year secular events. So, you know, Zohar is a good Jew, right? So he asks the question, he answers the question. He says, did you ever notice on the festivals, when we daven, that when the festival falls on Shabbat, we add a word in the daven? We add the word be'ahava. Did you ever notice that? It's like in parentheses. Did you ever wonder about that? Dafka, when the festival falls on Shabbat, then Hashem loves us more. I'm saying Hashem doesn't love us on Pesach, unless it's Shabbos. What is that all about? So the Zohar says you have to understand the difference between the festival and Shabbat. He says festivals, Chagim, Yom Tov, that's like Erusin. That's like engagement, Erusin. Shabbat is like marriage. Because what's the difference? Erusin is a time of intense emotion. It's a lot of excitement, a passion, a lot of expectation. I can't wait to see her. You're getting married in 6 months. You know, you go away for the weekend. You can't get off the phone with each other. You bring each other chocolates, flowers, and presents, and you leave notes all over the place, right? Then you get married. Now, I don't know how many husbands at 5 o'clock say, "Oh my God, I can't wait to get home to see my wife." And the people look at him like, "Aren't you married?" Like, you know, if I would come home every day and bring my wife chocolates and flowers and leave notes all over this, gee, you know, we'd have no money. That's ridiculous, right? But when you get married, you give your wife a gift that's much deeper. Give them yourself. So the festival's like it was. They come once a year. It's at the end of the day. You're excited. 30 days before the festival, you learn about the festival. All sorts of gifts, you know, presents, symbols, matzah, and wine, and lula, and shofar, all these things. And they come once a year. But you know what? The festival comes once a year. All year long. We can live without the festival. Shabbat comes every week. You can't go a week without Shabbat. So Shabbat is a much deeper relationship. And maybe you don't have the same excitement. You don't see people, you know, for a week before Shabbos anymore. Should be, you know, getting all excited. In fact, I know a couple people in my life. You go over to the Monday, say, how's it going? Say, hey, good Shabbos. Monday. But that's how they run the week. They're all excited about Shabbos. And most of us can't handle that. I have a friend, his name is Tom, and he's so into Shabbos that when you call up his cell phone, his message is, "Oh, good Shabbos, how are you? Please leave a message." Like, I could get a life, you know? It's like, we're not on the level. Right? But on the other hand, when Shabbat comes, I mean, I don't know about how you feel. I always feel it's an amazing thing. In winter, Shabbat comes in, whatever, 4:30. Oh, daddy, at 5:30. Right? In New York, you get 4 o'clock. Right? And in the summer, it comes at 8, 9, 10. No matter how late in the summer, how early in the winter, you're never ready. Don't think it's much. But I always think that if Shabbos would come a minute earlier, I wouldn't make it. But if Shabbos would come a minute later, I wouldn't make it either. Shabbat is a much deeper relationship. Which brings us back, what is it about Shabbat that we're trying to do? And I just want to share with you one idea. And then I promised we'd maybe have a little discussion about a recipe. More of a practical recipe for Shabbat. You know, on Shabbat morning, we say a very interesting thing in the Tfilot. Right? It says, we say this in Shachar, the morning prayers. Right? Moshe brought down 2 tablets. And in them it says, Shmirat Shabbat. Keep Shabbat. Right? So it says in the Torah. And then it gives me a quote. If that's what the davening is saying. It's a long time ago. Moshe descended Har Sinai with 2 tablets. And in those tablets was contained Shabbat. And so it is written about Shabbat in the Torah. What would I expect to find? What would be the quote? From where would quote be? Right, from the Ten Commandments, right? Moshe comes down, get two tablets, in the Mishabat. And so it says in the Torah, but that's not where the quote's from. What's the quote? Vishamru b'nei Yisrael the Shabbat. And this is part of the Shemoneh Esrei of Shabbat morning. Lasot v'tav Shabbat. That's not from the Ten Commandments. That's in Parashat Ki Tisa. And it's describing the actual celebration of Shabbat by the Jewish people. Why is that what's being quoted? I would expect it to say, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat, Shamor et Yom HaShabbat. So it's very interesting. What does that phrase mean? V'shamru b'nei Yisrael et HaShabbat, la'asot et HaShabbat. What does la'asot et HaShabbat? First of all, what does it mean, v'shamor? To guard, right? To keep, to watch. That what we want to be doing, watching Shabbos? Guarding Shabbos, right? So the truth is, and we actually mentioned this, but I'll remind you, we have a misperception about this word. In Israel, it's very easy. In Israel, you know, when you something that's very valuable, I don't know, you're taking my kid to school, right? So I'm giving you my child. So what do I say to you? I say, Shmuel, watch over him. Guard him. Take good care of him. Cherish him. Shmila really means to cherish. To take good care of. Shamor atim Shabbat. Take good care of Shabbat. Because if you take good care of Shabbat, Shabbat will take good care of you. Do I cherish Shabbat? By the way, and I know we spoke about this, pay attention to the words that we use and recognize what an impact that has on our surroundings, our children. What a difference it is between celebrating Shabbat and keeping Shabbat. Between, you know, what do we say? We say to make Shabbos. I think that's what Lasot et Yom HaShabbat means. Lasot means to turn this on. Sorry. Lasot et Yom HaShabbat, right, means that Bnei Israel hung on to Shabbat to make Shabbat. I think very often we accept Shabbat as a given. This is their routine. And this is what happens. Sunsets, you light your candles, you go to shul, you come home, you make kiddush, you do some dinner, you go to sleep. You wake up, you have some breakfast, you go to shul, you make some kiddush, you have some lunch, you go to sleep, if you're lucky, if you're not in Boca, right? Then you go back to shul, you eat some more, you make Abdallah, and you come home. And that's Shabbat. And if that's Shabbat, you're not cherishing Shabbat. You know? It's like, when was the last time you watched your wedding video? Right? When was the last time you watched your wedding video? I want to tell you something. If you take out your wedding video, you want your kids to watch your wedding video, for whatever the reason, right? You wouldn't put it on in the corner while you're vacuuming, talking on the phone. Because this is not just another video. You would, like, you know, get some candles and you would put the lights down and you would say to your husband, you know, listen, we're going to have an evening. We haven't done this in a long time. And you turn on the TV, and you sit down, and you just go back memory lane. It's a nice evening, you know? Cheap movie, right? Because you respect that that's not just a video. It's much, much more than a video. You know? If your kids make, you know, I don't know, the 25th anniversary video, and they put it together, and they want to show it to you for your 25th anniversary, you don't watch that like you watch Oprah while you're cooking for Shabbos, right? It's a different type of watching. So that's the question. How do we change keeping Shabbos to making Shabbos? And I'll give you a few examples. And what you do with this is up to you. Because up till now, it's all intellectual. Now, in order to explain this, I got to show you something. All right? Take a look. One second. What does the first pasuk say? Zachor et Yom HaShabbat l'kadsho. Okay? This is verse 8. What do you think that means? Zachor? This is the beginning of the Ten Commandments. Zachor et Yom HaShabbat l'kadsho. I want you to know, this is an actual mitzvah. You know, when you have a mitzvah to wear tefillin, there's something you have to do. but to fulfill mitzvah. So you put tefillin on. But what does that mean? I mean, this is an actual mitzvah per se. This is a biblical command. If you look in the list of the Rambam, Sefer Mitzvot, this is one of those mitzvot. If I get a mitzvah to light candles, I know what I have to do. I can talk about the beauty of light. I can talk about how, you know, when you take the candle, any way you turn it is up, and we have to be elevating our souls, and all the different messages of candles. And if I talk about them, and talk about them, and talk about them, and they're wonderful, but I don't actually do an action, I have not fulfilled the mitzvah. Right? I can talk about the mitzvah of putting on tzitzis. You want to fulfill the mitzvah. So, you know my opinion. What does it mean? What do you do with it? By the way, women make the mistake of assuming that tzitzit is not their mitzvah. I want you to understand that that's not true. This is very important. You remind me sometime, I'll get back to this. Why is it not true? Because, for whatever the reason, men were given the mitzvah. It happens to be because we have more problems than you do, but that's another discussion. Men were given the mitzvah to wear tzitzit. Women, for the most part, have the privilege of connecting their children to the mitzvah of tzitzit. It's much, much more important for a woman to understand the mitzvah of tzitzit than it is for a man. Because a man can learn it on later when he's wearing it. But a woman gets that window for about 2 or 3 years to connect her children to that mitzvah. It's an awesome thing. Awesome thing. So if I don't know what the mitzvah means, so we're missing something. So what is this mitzvah? Zachor et Yom Shabbat. Remember, what does that mean to remember Shabbat? I mean, maybe you fulfill it when you come home. You know, when it's 3 minutes to Shabbos, and you know, your kid is just coming out with his mitt and his glove. Say, don't you remember Shabbos? I don't know if that's... What do you think this means? And what does it mean, likadsho? To kodesh it. So?
To elevate it from another, from all the other ordinary days. To make it
okay, so what's the mitzvah? Just I mean, we can get all our children around the living room, we can sit on the floor, you know, get into like a lotus position and say, we're going to elevate this day. They look at you like you were wacko, but you know, okay. What are the practical mitzvahs?
Everything that you do on Shabbat.
Like what? Is there an obligation, a mitzvah, a biblical mitzvah, to put a white tablecloth on? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah.
I want you to know, my mother was shocked. Because when we got married, for whatever the reason, nobody got us white tablecloths. We got green tablecloths, pink tablecloths. And some of them were really beautiful tablecloths. So one week, my wife actually asked me, she said, like, is there a halacha against putting on a green tablecloth for Shabbos? I said, no, there really isn't. No. Like, people have the tradition of white tablecloth, whatever, so they should do it. So it's not a halacha. That can't be the fulfillment of the mitzvah. That is, there are a lot of customs that are in line. I want to know what the commandment is. What's the mitzvah? So listen to this. Right? There are two mitzvot on Shabbat that are fulfillment of this zachor. Because remember I told you that there are two versions that are slightly different than the Ten Commandments. In Devarim it says Shamor Yom HaShabbat, Shmirat Shabbat. And here it says Zachor Yom HaShabbat, and we mentioned that in Lachat Odi, Zachor V'Shamor V'Dibur Echad, Hashem said both these at the same time, whatever that means. So Chazal say, tradition teaches, the Gemara talks about this, Zachor represents the positive commandments, and Shamor represents the negative. I fulfill Shmirat Shabbat by not watching television. I fulfill Shmirat Shabbat by not answering the phone. How do I fulfill Zachor Tum Shabbat? I fulfill Zachor Tum Shabbat with all the mitzvot I say, all the things that I do that are commanded by the Torah. For example, Kiddush. Making Kiddush on Friday night is a mitzvah from the Torah, and it is a fulfillment of Zachor Tum Shabbat. Now, what does that mean? And how does it relate to Shamor? Let me tell you two ideas. First of all, I want you to know Shmirat Shabbat is about removing distractions. Zechirat Shabbat, Zachor, is what I put into the vacuum that's created by removing distractions. I think that the reason that that circle of kids that I discussed on us, thinking of Shabbat as don't, was because their families, and to a large extent, the Jewish community, has very much fulfilled the mitzvah of Shamor. We remove the distractions, but we don't know how to fill the vacuum. Now, what does that mean? As an example, okay. What is Friday night? I'll start with candlelight. Just out of curiosity. Don't answer this question. You're welcome to answer this question. You don't have to answer this question. I notice, because you know, I end up going to different places and sometimes I'm away from my family for Shabbat. So I've noticed that there are two different groupings in the world of candlelight. There are those where there's the family and then there's candlelight. And then there are those groups where candlelighting in the family is one. I grew up in a home where everything stopped before candlelighting. And my mother did not like candlelighting unless everybody was at the candles. All the children. My father. It was like unheard of that my father would be in another room in the house where my wife was lighting candles. Right? And we try. I don't always succeed. I'm not as on a higher level as my mother. Sometimes you're running, you have to run a minion, you know, the reader isn't ready, whatever it might be, right? But really, candlelighting should be an opportunity for all the children to come. And at least I can always speak personally, for me to stand and to watch. You know, the fact that my wife, it's interesting, by the way, that men are obligated to light candles as well. The mitzvah is given over to the woman because of all that it represents. Because the woman on a mystical level is of the partnership, is the one who brings light into the world. That's a whole other discussion, right? But what an opportunity. So then the question is, okay, let's say you actually do that. Let's say you actually stop. And the family comes together for candlelighting. First of all, I want you to know something very powerful about the way we do beginnings. We've spoken about this before. Beginnings are very powerful. What you do with them, how you start them. You know, do you walk into an interview, a job interview, talking on the cell phone saying, right? You don't do that. Because how you walk in and how you begin, it frightens me that you guys got that so quickly, but okay, right? So if Shabbat starts with the entire family together taking a Pesach Zman, that's a very deep idea. Then the question is, okay, let's say you do that. What do you do with that? I happen to think, by the way, that women, and especially the women who are lighting candles, I think this is a mitzvah that most people get. I don't think that, you know, I mean, there are a lot of ideas that are very beautiful about candlelighting. But I wonder how much the children, and especially the husbands, get this. Like, what are you thinking as a husband when your wife is lighting candles? Are you utilizing that opportunity? This is, by the way, an amazing experiment. You know, to turn to your husband one night at a Friday night dinner, you know, when you're not putting him on the spot, if he says, I don't know, maybe he's one of the husbands who never gets to actually see you light candles, but if he's actually there, well, what are you thinking when I'm lighting candles? This would be an incredible discussion. What are you thinking when you're lighting candles? I mean, this is an enormous opportunity. You know, if the candles, you know, we start Shabbat, symbols are very important. We start Shabbat with two candles. And there's a minhag to light, also some people light however many candles for children, but essentially the basic, you know, the basic core candle lighting is two candles. We finish Shabbat with the Havdalah flame, which is supposed to be one candle, one flame of many wicks, because that's what Shabbat is all about. Shabbat is all about all the different candles coming together. That's what Shabbat's supposed to do. So when you light candles, it's an interesting question. How far apart have we grown during the week? That's what happens. We grow a little bit apart during the week, and we come a little bit more together on Shabbat. Right? So, do we recognize that? What do you do with that? What do each of us bring into the equation? Then you get to, I'm skipping shul for the moment, because that's a whole challenge in and of itself. Then you get to, like, Friday night dinner. Shalom Aleichem. What does Shalom Aleichem mean? Why do you sing Shalom Aleichem? It's interesting, by the way, there are two different customs. Some people sit for Shalom Aleichem, and some people stand. Right? Personally, I'm into, you know, why stand when you can sit? But, you know, whatever it is. They're very different energies. Right? But it's an amazing thing that you begin your Friday night dinner with the concept of shalom, of shlemut. Shalom, by the way, it's an interesting thing. People don't know this halacha. When you go to the bathroom, you're not allowed to say hello to somebody in the bathroom. It's halacha. Now, whether our bathrooms are defined in the way their bathrooms were, because, you know, back then the bathroom was a disgusting place, it was an open hole, right? And whether that constitutes today when we have, you know, sort of much more sanitary toilets and stalls is an interesting question. But there are many who believe that a bathroom today is like a bathroom then to a certain degree. But in any case, the reason you don't say hello in a bathroom is because shalom is the name of God. So you don't say the name of God in the bathroom. And there's some who have the custom, and this is my custom, not to talk at all in the bathroom, because the bathroom is a very physical place, right? And you want to remember that you're involved in that part of yourself which is much more animal-like, and you want to distance it to some degree, and that's a whole discussion. And it gets interesting, you know, when you have students, and sometimes you're, you know, washing at the sink, and somebody walks in, and you don't want to say hello, and whatever, right? But, right. Well, I want you to know, this is an interesting question, I want you to know, we love to look in the world, at the world as black and white, okay? I'm more in the get-a-life crowd. And I was like, that's my personal minhag, and I don't do it. But look, if my kid has to go to the bathroom, so of course I'm going to talk to my kid in the bathroom. You know, like, okay, so then I don't, you know, I wouldn't say to like, you know, it wouldn't work, right? But you know, sometimes people want to have a schmooze with you in the bathroom. It's just like not appropriate, the whole discussion. And it's interesting, when you're in a public facility, you hear like people, they have whole conversations in the bathroom. They talk to each other from different stores. I don't understand this. Right? You would never see in yeshiva. Yeah. And doesn't that strike you like there's something inappropriate? Like you're on the phone and you're talking to your wife and you're in the bathroom. It's just like, it doesn't work for me, right? In yeshiva, by the way, the bathroom is a very quiet place because you're in a physical thing. And stuff. So we'll share, whatever it might be. But I didn't mention it for that. We don't say hello in the bathroom because shalom is the name of God. So think about this. Shalom represents shlemut, wholeness, completion. All of completion and wholeness and perfection in this world emanates from that total perfection, which is Hashem. Right? So shalom aleichem has many different levels. It could be, you know, that legend about the angels, etc. Right? Everybody knows that angels, right? The angels come and they see, okay, we're going to get to that in a minute, right? It could also mean shalom aleichem. Let Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, be upon you. Do you let a little God into your life? Everybody knows the famous story of the Kutzker Rebbe. Right? What people don't know is that the Kutzker Rebbe was 6 years old when this happened. Nachum Mendel of Kutzk was a child genius. He was an Eloi. He was an incredibly brilliant kid. And by the time he was 6 years old, he was giving shiur, he was giving musar shmuzes. You know, sort of a little like, you know, you have to learn how to speak Lashon Hara, and you have to learn, there was apparently a rav in his town when he was a little kid, who recognized that for a child to be speaking to adults on a certain level was a very holy thing, because you couldn't say to the child, well, do you speak Lashon Hara, because he's 6 years old, he has no chataim, he's not doing anything wrong yet, right? So every Shabbos and Shalosh Shittos, this boy would stand up for 15 minutes and he would give a shmooze, he would give a shir, right? And there was once a misnagid, you know, somebody who had issues with chassidim. And the thought of a 6 year old little boy in Strymo giving a shir was just like, well, who is this kid? What's going on? Let's have some Torah. So he asked him that famous question. Okay, so, you know, they opened up the floor of questions. You imagine a little 6 year old boy. He was a really, he was a genius, right? So this guy asked him, okay, so where is God? Good question, right? 6 year old. Where is God? Right? So Menachem Mendel said, wherever you let him in. Now that's very deep, because that's very true. And that's really what Shabbat is about. We spend so much time trying to get to the moment that we always miss the moments we're already in. Did you ever have that experience? Space is your space, and that's why when you walk in a public domain on Shabbat, you're carrying, until you walk 4 cubits with something, you have not left the space that was already yours. And there's a reason, it's not just the technicality, the Torah and Halacha, they want us to be aware of this Halacha. They create these parameters so that we will be aware of all of these different ideas that all converge. It's important for me to know that this is my space. It's important for me to know that when I carry something, I make a demonstration that it's mine. It's important for me to be aware that on Shabbat, I want to remember that nothing's really mine. In a healthy way. Only things that are really mine are the things that I give away, that can never be taken from me. Right? And that brings us back to the question of Eruv. So what is this Eruv? How does that solve that problem? Yes?
I missed what you said about why it was Eruv.
No, in other words, like, when I'm sitting here, without going into details, there are different types of spaces. There's a private space, like my home. Then there's a public space, like Broadway in New York City. Then there's something called the Carmelite, which is kind of a mixture between private and public. It's not biblically public, it's rabbinically public, like in synagogue. Now, whatever it might be, right? Or things like that. There are buildings within which, according to some authorities, they're actually considered public domains. That's a whole other discussion. But we create private domains, right? When I pick up a sidur inside Boca Raton Synagogue, I'm not making a statement that it's mine. It very clearly belongs to the synagogue. In fact, that's why people put all sorts of signs on their siddur if it's their siddur, because they know that when they pick it up, it doesn't. You can put your siddur down, go to the bathroom, come back, and it's gone. Because you haven't made a statement that it's yours. And certainly if you leave it there, you know, if you forget the siddur there, and you want to come back and get it next week, it's yours. Who gave anybody the right to pick it up? It's not in your private space. But if you put your siddur on your desk in your office or your home, nobody's going to pick it up and take it off your desk because that's yours. So when I pick up a siddur in my home, it's already mine. I've made the statement that it's mine. There's nothing wrong with things being mine, as long as I'm not creating that statement on Shabbat. Now we have another question, which is how, when I'm in my home, and I clearly the things that are in my home are mine, how do I create an energy which negates that energy. There's nothing wrong with everything that you're in this world. For 6 days you're working to establish that you've created things and that you own, and that you own things, etc. But one day a week you want to remember you don't own them. So how do you remember that what you think is yours is never yours? Well, that's your Shabbat table. That's your Friday night Shabbat table. Anyway, she started talking, blew my mind. Her daughter was, I think, 8 years old. And she was coming in for basically a check. Because when her daughter was born, she was born with severe congenitive heart failures and all sorts of problems with her heart. They had to replace valves. They had to unblock the aorta. I mean, just unbelievable surgeries. This kid had multiple surgeries by the time she was 2 years old. And they told this woman, in fact, once this girl in one of the surgeries, they had to get a medevac helicopter to fly her and the girl to Boston. And they had literally 2 hours to save her life, and they couldn't get the insurance, and her life was like 10 minutes, like they almost lost it. Anyway, the doctors told her that she should try very hard not to let their daughter cry. Because the baby's heart was so weak, if she would cry, that she could die. How could you imagine? They have an infant, and the infant can't cry. She said to the Rebbe, I became the fastest cry to milk in human history, right? I had like a 3-second record. Like, nobody did it as fast as I did. She said, the baby slept next to her in the bed. She said, for 2 years, she was careful. She couldn't really move around because the baby was next to her. And she would just, you know, sometimes she would just go to sleep with the baby at her breast just so that the baby wouldn't cry, right? When she was 2, they finally had the surgery that ended all the surgeries. And they told her, your baby's fine. And she's going to be okay. It's going to work out. And at the end, after the follow-up visit, whenever, she finally asked the doctor, well, is it okay now if she cries? So the doctor said, yeah, now you can let her cry. So that night she went home, and eventually the baby started to cry. And she took a moment to just hold her baby in her arms and to watch her cry, and to appreciate what a gift it is to have your baby cry. Now, we're not capable of living in that moment, which is not. Right? So, like, your children are crying, you know, or something happens, you're not living in what a gift to hear my child cry. Talk chas v'shalom to anyone who ever lost a child. What an amazing moment to hear your child cry. That your child's at a stage where all they want is you. What an unbelievable moment. Do we really appreciate that moment? Do we live in that moment? Do we appreciate all our moments? Now, we're not capable, most of us, of living inside the moment all the time. So that's what Shabbat is about. Many of us are not even capable of living in the moment all of Shabbat. That's what Friday night is about. Many of us are not even capable of living in the moment all of Friday night. At least Friday night at the Shabbat table, when you get to Shalom Aleichem, to take a moment, you know? There are certain experiences in life that are so obviously about the experience. I remember when Dorit and I were going out, James Taylor came to Israel. And I took her to a James Taylor concert. It was in some of the pools beneath the old city walls. You know, and I brought wine and cheese, and we had a, you know, picnic, you know. There's like, I don't know, 30,000 people out on the lawn, you know. You're not going there because you can't wait to see the end of the concert. You don't want the concert to end. You just want to be in the moment. And you actually know, right, because you're already very serious, that this is something that's going to be one of those memories. Like, you ever have one of those experiences? You know this is going to be one of those memories. Do you revel in it? I'll give you a great example of this. My favorite part of any trip, right, is the trip getting there. Like, if you're taking your kids, you know, to, I don't know, into an alligator farm. So the drive, half an hour, like, you get out, and everybody's in the car, and you're on the adventure. And some people, they're so, like, stressed because they just want to get there. But I love that half an hour, 40 minutes. And if you get into traffic, it's longer, you know? So it's great. Because you're not there yet, so there's the anticipation. It's never going to live up to your anticipation. Never. It's always going to be better to experience the anticipation. Do we experience the moment? You know? And what an awesome thing to sit at the Shabbos table, take a moment, you're singing Shalom Aleichem, to look around the table, to see who's with you, to see the guests that are with you, and to just think, Shalom Aleichem. Can you bring a little Shalom into your life? You know? That's Shalom Aleichem. You know? By the way, since we mentioned that legend of the angels, right? So what are those angels? What is an angel? Right, you know what? You remind me to be in next class. This is a more than a 30-second. We have to finish. And I'll tell you one last thing. You remind me, okay? What is an angel? One last thing, because I think that this is such an unappreciated part of the Shabbat experience. And that's Berachat HaPanim.
There is no moment in the week that I love more than the blessing of the children. If I could think of a single thing that is the most difficult sacrifice personally when I go away for Shabbat, it's this moment. This is such an awesome moment. First of all, it blows my mind. I've met people who don't know about this custom. It's not a halacha, by the way. It's not a halacha. But it's a beautiful custom to bless your children. Now, what does it mean to bless your children? What is that about? The blessing of children on Friday night. What am I supposed to be thinking? What could I be thinking? Right? So, I'm going to leave that for next time. Now we've got two pieces. Angels and Birchat Hamanim. I'll give you a couple of pieces of food for thought. You know, when I was a kid, I'll spare you all the details, but I used to, for whatever the reason, and I think I used to just attract it. I used to get into all sorts of scrapes. I got mugged, etc. So eventually, you know, I decided enough was enough. I had a good friend who was pushing me, and I went to start taking karate. Right? So, I don't know, it's the 6th or 7th grade, whatever it was. So, you know, you have this illusion when you take karate that you're going to walk in there and 2 weeks later it's going to be, wah! Right? It's not really the way it is. Karate, as a discipline, takes years to master, right? And if you're doing it for self-defense, I mean, it's a good 2-3 years if you're in a serious style before you can even become remotely confident down the street. Anyway, so I did that for years and years and years later, when we were already married, I was back in Pittsburgh, and I had sort of let go of karate because that style didn't exist in Israel, and I was in the army, I figured, I got a machine gun, it's cool, right? Years later, I was in Pittsburgh for the year, and I was just looking for a way to get back in shape. My brother-in-law was at Pitt University, and he had this amazing deal, $25 a month. So I went back to this dojo to study, just to get back in shape. And they had a deal, one night a week they did karate, one night a week they did jiu-jitsu. So you were already paying for it, it was free. So I went. It was an epiphany. It was such a discovery. It was a whole different world. The fundamental difference between karate and jiu-jitsu, there are many, but the fundamental, if I had to pick one that stands out, in karate, force meets force. Somebody throws a punch at you, you throw a block. You meet his force with your force. In jiu-jitsu, you get out of the way. When he throws a punch at you, right, you just step aside, and there are different ways to do that, and then you use his energy to send him wherever you want him to go. The first thing that was amazing about this is, whereas in karate it takes years, in jiu-jitsu it takes a month. Months. Very quickly, you can learn so many things and become so proficient that you can defend yourself on the street. We developed this whole system to teach girls. There was a big problem of rape on the college campuses, and he was developing the system, and I got into it as an instructor to teach girls how to defend themselves against rape in 6 months. You could never do that in karate. The second thing that fascinated me was how much more powerful it was when instead of using your energy, you were letting somebody else use theirs, right? So the difference between children and teens, I think, is that children, little kids, it's karate. For the most part. Teenagers is jiu-jitsu. You know, when the kid is standing at the door and he's 4 years old, I'm not coming. You know, so to do jiu-jitsu and say, listen, it's up to you. If you want to come, if you don't. No, it's a 4-year-old kid, right? That's why I think fathers have an easier time with that. Because, you know, the rich are like, slump, all right. I mean, I just put him on the back, come on, we're finished, right? But you can't do that with a teenager. A teenager, right, he never has to get to the temper. Because he already knows that you love him, that you want him, but you're cool if he doesn't come. That's number one. Number two, once you get to that point with a teenager, but with anybody, you are the only person, the closer you are to a person, you know, like I can be a Rav, if that's what I wanted to be, let's say, for, I don't know, anybody, except for my family. I can't be my wife's Rebbe. I can't be a Rebbe, because I'm a husband, you know? And whatever issues I have with Judaism, whatever issues she has with Judaism, we can be a sounding board. You know, if she wants to talk about it, I'm open to talking about it. But I would never, you know, do what I do in class. My wife doesn't interest me. She'll find a Rebbe. She won't find a Rebbe. In fact, I'm the person most suited to turn someone, my children, my wife, whatever it is, my parents, the furthest away from Judaism. So if you really get that, then you get to the third point. And the third point is, it's not enough just to tolerate where a person is at. It's not enough just to demonstrate that you're open to whatever they want to do. You have to deeply respect where they're at. You cannot fake respect. Especially with children. They will know when you respect them and when they don't. If your child was brought up in an inquiring world, in an inquisitive society, and he's on a level where he's challenging issues. You know, Rav Kook talks about this. He has an article called Kfirah Shehi Emunah, denial which is faith. He says there's something very deep about atheism, very holy. Because what the atheist is basically saying is, if this is the God that you would have me believe in, I'm not interested. because God has to be better than that. And he's right. So the Judaism that a particular person, now this is already opinion, is not interested in, you're probably not interested in either. I'm certainly not interested in it. The question is how you communicate to that child that the Judaism that you love is different. The only way you can do that is to respect so much ad nauseum where he's at. Sometimes a child will get curious as to why you so respect where he's at and yet you're so into it. What do you see in that? And you're just waiting for that question. And when that question comes, if you're lucky, don't jump on it. Say, oh, that's a good question. I gotta think about that. You know? There's also something very powerful about acknowledging children's questions as being your own. We don't have all the answers. Right? And the last thing I'll say to you, and again, this is a longer discussion. I believe that people become curious when they see models. If we want, at whatever age, our children to be inspired, we have to be inspired. So the first question is, you know, I'm not saying, sometimes you see, you know, there are different factors. Sometimes you see children of parents who are inspired, and they struggle with this, because the parents were so inspired they had no time for the children. You also have to have time for your children. But the combination of those two factors usually leads to magnificent results. Take davening, for example. You know, sometimes you meet parents and the kid doesn't want to go to shul. So instead of asking why doesn't the kid want to go to shul, ask why would the kid want to go to shul? And you'll have your answer. And more often than not, the kid will be right. And what you do about that's an interesting question. You know, I went through that stage when I was at a certain point. I was actually in grade school. I didn't want to go to shul. So my father one Shabbos morning said, you know what? If you don't want to go to shul, I'm not going to shul. I don't want to be in shul without you. I'll be depressed about not going to shul, but I won't go to shul. And he stayed home, and we did shul at home. And we did this a few weeks, and then I felt so guilty we went to shul. Right? And we got into deep discussions about what shul was about and why he liked shul, and then my parents decided it was time to move. We went to a different place so we could have a more meaningful shul experience. Same is true with candlelighting. You know, you can't force a teenage son to be there for candlelighting if he hasn't been doing it all along. Right? You can make Friday night a meaningful experience. I happen to think, by the way, that what makes things meaningful for people is that they have a chance to be heard. They have a chance to share. Is your Shabbat table an experience of dialogue, of discussion? And you can talk about it with your children, you know, what would make Shabbat more meaningful? What would you really enjoy doing? You can also ask them what they can't stand about Shabbat. You get some interesting answers, you know? Most kids want to spend time with their parents if they feel that their parents are really respecting where they're at. Some kids want to spend time with their parents with their friends. Some kids want to spend time with their parents without their friends. And I'll end with this. Just realize I'm at the edge of the abyss. Because my oldest is 13. Let's see if I'm a big talker in 5 years. No?
Wow. 2 years.
2 years? All right. Food for thought next time.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.